This is episode 41 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
I shot you in the chest, point blank. And you got up, walked back into town. Didn't even go to the hospital until the next day.
You tried to drown yourself, and an earthquake saved your life.
You drank poison. I buried you and you went to the other place. It came back.
If you come to me, but will not leave your family, you cannot be my follower.
Is that from your book?
No, Kevin, that's Jesus.
Well, I'm not fucking Jesus.
I'm not saying you are, but the beard looks good on you.
All the way from Cranston, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's chat.
Episode 1.
Suddenly I'm hitting. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am so excited to be joining you here. And if you're new, so happy to have you. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And I think that I'm just never ready to leave Miracle, ever.
Oh, gosh. Ever. I'm just never ready to leave The Leftovers, because even though it is such a sad and trying show and subject content, my gosh, it's just such a great show.
Yes, it is. And I'm glad to be back. And I'm even more excited because we actually have some more comments from Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata to share with everybody that is live right now. We're doing a new thing. We're actually live streaming every single episode of The Living Reminders for season 3 on Facebook. So we are live if you care to join us there later on in future episodes, or if you are with us now on live on Facebook, I'm so excited. And one of the treats that we have is, again, another few words from Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata from our prior interview that we did, and they actually commented pretty specifically on the cold open and also that ending that we saw with Nora.
Sarah.
Yeah, Sarah. That's a valid point. Good point on that one.
We must call her by her name, which is Sarah.
So, my love, what do you think? We actually have not talked about this episode yet at all.
No,
really.
We haven't.
We watched it last night, and then she went to bed because my wife, it has not the flu, but she is quite sick. So she's being a trooper.
Pretty sure it is the flu, and we're just saying that it's not the flu.
We're going to will it away.
Yeah, we're willing it away. But our son had the flu, and I have all of the same symptoms. So I'm pretty sure I have the flu, which is why I sound a little stuffy. But guys, this episode needs to be talked about. So I'm here. I'm being strong. I've got my epic mug of tea, and I'm ready to talk about Miracle, which is now like straight up Jardin/Miracle.
Right.
Whoa.
Okay. So let's get into it.
Okay.
Now that we're back, we're here, we're ready to go. What's your Damon rating?
My Damon rating
for episode 301, the Book of Kevin.
Yeah, I would give it a 4.
Really? What, you're giving it a 4?
Yeah, like a solid 4.
Okay.
A solid 4. Like, it was really, really good. And I enjoyed it a lot.
I'm surprised because you usually bandy about the 5s.
I
left
know.
And right. You usually do that.
There were a lot of things that I was like, what the hell? What the hell? Why do you have a cast on, Nora? Where's Lily? What happened to Lily? Yep. Like, I had way too many questions. And why is future Nora called Sarah? Or are we supposed to think that it's Nora's ancestor or something? I had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. So there were so many whys. And me being greedy, I just wanted to know all the answers. So because of that, I couldn't give it a 5. But really, it deserves to be a 5. Let's be real. Okay, it gets a 5.
I knew that was coming. I had a feeling. I had a big feeling on that one. For myself, I'm giving it 4.5 Damons. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm giving it 4.5 Damons is because I thought it was a fantastic setup. I thought It introduced you back to everybody back in the cast, okay. back in Jarden. It even set up some changes that you're gonna find out very soon. However, the one thing that bothered me a little bit was that the irony is that it was trying to do too much.
Okay.
Trying to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I can appreciate that. It just too many characters, too many stories to catch you back up on, too many things to take care of for the specific attention that this show needs. And again, we're only getting 8 episodes, so mm-hmm. it has to make very specific use of all of the real estate that it has at its disposal.
Okay. You know,
we have 8 hours to tell this story. So I want to get to it as soon as you can. So, but yeah, 4.5 Daemons. Great to get everybody back on the show. Great to get everybody back in tune mm-hmm. with for their viewers. And that is that. On Twitter, we have Boffington Pope. Yeah. Oh, so you want to read it?
I'll check this out because okay. I know you wanted to take a look into our leftovers chat. Buffington Post, the P. Witty, tweeted 3.5 out of 5. Daemons, of course. I cried twice.
Leftovers chat. But Buffington Post, the P.
Sorry?
The time jump left something to be desired as far as context. So I understand your pain, Buffington Post. I totally understand. And I love Buffy. Jane Choi on Facebook said, I hope we find out how she died, presumably. I wonder if it's related to a miracle that took place. Like every time a miracle happens, something bad happens to a good person. For example, Nora's injury, Lily's gone. Mary's miracle resulted in her now being controlled by Matt. I liked the cold open. I thought the way the camera transitioned from the mother laying down next to all of the dead bodies. I thought they were living. I thought they were living as well.
I'm not going
to
lie.
To Evie waking up next to the living, to the guilty remnant is so seamless. And it's same at the end with the pigeons going from Jarden to Australia. Jane did say that she's a little disappointed that there isn't an opening credit sequence with the title song and hopes that there is one next week. So because of this, she gives it 4 out of 5 Daemons. This is what we saw last season. There was a cold open. It was mm-hmm. the woman, the like cave woman
right.
giving birth, and it was just a cold open. And then we did get actually a whole brand new title sequence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very like upbeat,
right.
the sparkly people.
Let the mystery be.
Yeah, yeah.
Which that song has invaded my life again, and I'm not happy about it.
Okay.
I'm not, because that's, I hated that song for so long, and then I just found out I really like it, which it blows my mind.
That blows my mind as well.
I know. I
get it. James Lattimore gave it 5 Big Daemons. This was an event. Felt like I was watching the Super Bowl.
Yes.
I hear you, James. I hear you. So, such an epic, epic season opener.
So we're getting a good wide range of ideas from people and a good wide range of Daemons.
Yes.
Some people really loved it. Some people were kind of like halfway on it, which makes sense because these premiere episodes, again, they have to cover so much.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do so much, right? So my love, are you ready to figure out that title?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's do it. Let's play Figure Out That Title. All right, my love. This one is usually yours. You have
you
come.
You can take it.
No. You have come to dominate this segment over the years, and I won't take that away from you. So the Book of Kevin, my love, figure out that title for us.
It was the easiest title ever.
And like I said last year, I'm not sure if this is more of an indictment on the titles or you, because now they're a little bit easier to figure out nowadays.
I mean, obviously, it's about the book that Matt is writing about Kevin.
Right.
You know, and then you think about the Bible and the books that are named after different dudes from the Bible. And by the way, I was so shocked that Nora, future Nora, ends up getting a biblical name.
Right.
Because I'm going through the list of everybody in the show, and we've got Thomas, we've got Matt, you know, we've got John, we've got Mary, we've got so many biblical names, and then Nora gets a biblical name at the end. So interesting. But nonetheless, obviously, the Book of Kevin, meaning probably another sacred piece of
literature
that maybe will be written. So that is it. That is the name, the title game, which is not a game anymore because it was so simple.
It's time to reheat the leftovers. All right. So this one, the details, directed by Mimi Leader,
mm-hmm.
and written by one Damon Lindelof and Patrick Somerville, who was a writer from last season,
mm-hmm.
Which he's a great return. I'm very excited that he is back. So that's what you got. Those are the two cool. writers. I will find the DP. I will find it.
Okay. But, all right.
So my love, how are we going to attack this one? I mean, do you want to just get it out of the way?
Just do it. Just jump in. Let's start the discussions where the discussions need to be.
All right. So let's just jump right in. And I'm surprised by this, but a lot of people didn't know that this was Nora at the end of the episode.
What do you mean people didn't know?
They weren't sure. They weren't like, is this Nora or is this somebody else?
I didn't know.
No. I think we were pretty clear.
Well, listen, I watched this show called Outlander, and there's this guy that plays two characters in it. One of them is a super distant relative, and he's the same guy because he's supposed to look that well. So, like, look the same. So I was in there, and she's called Sarah.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, maybe this is, like, very distant descendant of Nora.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It's Nora, just with a different name. But I first time when I saw it, I totally thought maybe this is someone else. Maybe this is an alternate universe.
Yeah, you see, I'm not sure if they're going to do alternate universes here. Because like Damon and Tom said, they've kept, even though they've had this one supernatural event, they've kept the story pretty localized mm-hmm. to the real world. And do you think they're really going to splinter off and into an alternate
universe? Why couldn't it be
universe?
A descendant of Nora's or an ancestor of Nora's? She was on a bike.
Was on a bike, but if you saw...
Was it her same bike?
I don't know if it was the same
bike. Oh my God. Someone needs to find out. So when Nora takes a ride yep. after she has a ride on Kevin, but on Bumtang, she goes for a ride on a bike. And I wonder if it's the same bike because I know they had like a close-up shot because they didn't reveal Sarah's face, until the very end. Mm-hmm. But you got to see a lot of this pedaling. So I'm wondering if it's actually the same bike. I highly doubt she would have taken her bike to Australia. She could just buy a new bike in Australia.
Yeah,
that would have been cool if it was the same bike.
Unless they moved all their crap from Jarden.
In one big box.
Well, I will say that it is most certainly Australia, the place.
How do you know? You've never been.
Well, if you'd like me to tell you, I would be happy to tell you, my darling. The reason why I know that it's Australia is because due to the words on the back of the church that Nora visited when she was she was giving the pigeons over to this lady. The words on the back of the church said MacKillop Church. And that's actually, I looked it up because I'm a psycho.
No, you are a leftovers nerd.
And it actually refers to Mary Helen MacKillop, who was a nun in Australia.
Okay.
And she's actually the first, I think, and only Australian saint, as a matter of fact.
Didn't even know.
She was an Australian nun who has been declared as a saint by the Catholic Church. She was of Scottish descent. She was actually born in Melbourne, but was best known for her activities in South Australia.
Wow.
Together with the Reverend Julian Tennyson Woods, she founded the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart, called the Josephites, a congregation of religious sisters that established a number of schools and welfare institutions throughout Australasia, with an emphasis on education for the rural poor.
So basically you're saying it is Australia.
Yes.
Period.
Indeed.
Okay.
Indeed. And so I thought that was a fantastic way to end the episode because we're having flash forwards, we're having flashbacks, we're having time jumps. This is, first of all, typical. Not typical. This is like Damon Lindelof at his best.
Okay. I would agree.
Giving you nuggets to consume in the immediacy, but also push the story forward enough where you're like, okay, where was Nora? Is that Nora? She's aged. And just, oh my God, exquisite Damon Lindelof.
And she totally gave up the mom haircut.
Totally. And I'm kind of happy about that because the mom haircut ain't doing it for
you. You're not a mom. You don't know what it's like.
Well, technically, she's not a mom anymore either. Just throwing that out there.
Break my heart, Blake. Break my heart. God.
Okay, so we'll get
that
more.
That's a low diss.
Well, it listen, fact, not opinion. Okay,
actually,
fact, not opinion.
I think her haircut is really cute.
I don't like the. I could do season two, Nora Hare. Wasn't a huge fan, but I could do it. I was a bigger fan of season one, Nora Hare. Season three, Nora Hare, not cutting it. It's too curly for me.
Anyway.
So we spoke to Damon and Tom about the ending and also the beginning, the cold open. And I think instead of us talking about it with you and I right now, why don't we just actually play what we had to say with them? What do you think, kiddo?
Yes. Yes.
All right, let's do it.
That episode was amazing.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Yeah, congratulations on making a fantastic first episode. And the thing that really jumped out to me was, again, the cold open, that it just kind of came out of nowhere. And it's about this family and a mother and the father and son and faith and thinking that maybe something is going to happen where they're going to be taken away. And then, Damon, you actually used this term earlier, bookend. It's bookended with what appears to be Nora in the future. What also appears to be Australia. So is that Nora scene reflective of what happens in the cold open? You know, you see the mother in the cold open kind of abandon her family, or the family abandon her. Is the same thing happening to Nora?
I
stumped him.
This is one of those areas where I feel like us talking about our intention as writers is not as interesting as the conversation that happens amongst the fans. Mm-hmm. Suffice to say, the very fact that you're asking that question, was our intention. There's a clear straight line between the fact that we chose to open and end the episode in the way that we did, but more importantly, visual motifs like the birds, that sort of connect the two. The more interesting question to us as storytellers is, and in the same way that we started the second season with the cave woman, is how much of the story is meant to be allegory and thematic versus literal. All I'll say is that's going to be an ongoing conversation that will continue all the way through the finale and hopefully beyond. But that's all I can say as to my intention. Parada may have had a different one, but I'm curious to hear what he has to say about it.
Well, let me just begin by saying this is another case where I feel like
Tom, can I just interrupt one more second before? Yeah, sure. I also have to feel like I don't think we've talked about Mimi enough in this in this podcast, and Mimi Leader, who directed not just the this premiere that we're talking about now, but all the premiere and the finale of last year, the finale this year, which is astonishing. But particularly as it relates to this sequence, the amount of time and energy and focus and art that Mimi brought to that sequence is just astonishing, and really transcended all of our intentions in terms of bringing it to life, because it was no easy task. She's a true genius, and she doesn't get heralded enough as it relates to this show. And I just forgot to say that, and I apologize, Tom, for interrupting you.
Oh, not at all, because it is just a gorgeous opening. And I just wanted to say, Damon, it was a case where I think I was probably the person who brought up the Millerites in the room, because I'd been doing some reading about the Second Great Awakening, and I was just struck by, these people who thought the world was going to end in 1844, and gave up everything they owned and waited for the end of the world. But I was just talking about it in general, and then I don't know what point, Damon, you came up with it, but I remember you basically, it was another one of those cases where you kind of imagined it whole. You just said, here's what I want the opening to be. And it was like that little movie that Mimi made such a beautiful piece of film out of, emerge. And, looking at it in retrospect now, to me, it is the perfect opening for the season. On the one hand, these are people waiting for a departure. They think they can predict a departure. They're taking this thing that we've experienced is this huge disruptive mystery. And for them, it's this blessing that they're hoping for. And of course, they're disappointed. And in being disappointed and having their confidence shattered, they are now in the position of the leftovers. It's the people who've lost the explanation, you know, for the world. And now the question is, what do you do now? And what does she do? She just finds those few people who still believe what she believes, and she huddles with them. You know, that's all we can do is huddle with the people who, you know, who we're connected to, and try and figure out what to do next. And it's just a beautiful overture for the season, because it's about faith and it's about, you know,
sacrifice.
Yeah. You know, what you're left with when your faith has been demolished.
So thank you to Damon and Tom for commenting. And I think this is their only
joint
comments together about the cold open and the ending of the premiere episode. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about this.
I know.
And there's one thing I wanted to point out. There was a lot of information given there, talking about faith and destroying faith, and what does it mean, and how is it going to be spoken about and addressed for the remainder of the for the final season. However, there was one point that was brought up by Tom, and I'm not sure if he meant to bring this up.
Ooh, okay.
Which was the Millerites.
Yes.
What the hell are Millerites, right?
It's those people who are standing on top of their houses.
Well, that is possible. They don't necessarily distinctly say that these were Millerites.
Wasn't he saying like a date in 1844, and wasn't that the date that the guy circled?
Yes, yes. So it's not distinctly saying it's the Millerites. However, it could be.
It's the Millerites.
Yes, and I give credit to Greg Cuoco, a listener of ours, and actually brought this up with us and said, loved the opening as it really sets the tone for people being disappointed when something they have been sold as gospel does not come true. And he brings up, without hearing this podcast first, brings up saying the Millerite movement in the 1800s really does show the aspect of belief and loss of belief that directly relates to Jardin and what is going on now in the world of the leftovers. The end was super eerie, with an older Nora delivering white doves, and that relates to the opening. And the Millerites used messenger birds as well. Great episode, setting us up for more questions. Greg, you know what? Honest to God.
Bam! Just like that.
I agree.
I mean, oh my God, Greg, that is amazing. And again, because I am a psycho, I went out and I went ahead.
Don't call yourself a psycho. You can say a passionate, you know, nerd. Just you are passionate about the show, or you're a podcaster who needs to do his research.
That's true. So for all of you who have no idea what the hell Millerites or Millerism is, this is what it is. The Millerites were followers of the teachings of William Miller, who in 1833 first shared publicly his belief that the second advent of Jesus Christ would occur roughly in between the years of 1843 and 1844. October 22nd, 1844, the day Jesus was expected to return, ended, of course, like any other day, to the disappointment of the Millerites. Both Millerite leaders and followers were left generally bewildered and disillusioned, and responses varied, of course. Some Millerites continued to look daily for Christ's return, and others predicted different dates, among them April, July, and October 1844. Some theorized, however, that the world had entered the seventh millennium, the great Sabbath, and that therefore the saved should not work. Others acted as children, basing their belief on Jesus' words in Mark 10:15, "Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it." And ultimately, they were teaching that Christ was now sitting on a white cloud and must be prayed down. Probably the majority, however, simply gave up their beliefs and attempted to rebuild their lives. So you can actually see all of those reactions in the cold opening.
Yes.
People acting like children, like the lady, kind of acting like a child almost, like, putting her undying faith in what she believes is going to be the rapture.
I mean, giving their goat, giving their clothes, giving their belongings, just with this grin on their face.
Right, because, happy to do it.
You know, like, good times are coming, man. I don't need this goat where I'm going.
Right, and then you see another action from her family saying, I'm done, dude.
Oh, I'm done. Heart,
and
but yes.
You know, when she's all happy, the next date comes and she goes to grab her husband's hand and he pulls it away.
Yep.
And she's putting up the ladder and everybody's kind of staring at her and mocking at her. And even the husband and everything, they're about to take off. They go, you know, and like you see all of these reactions and it is indicative, I think, of what, as Greg said, is happening in The Leftovers and for season three. Of The Leftover, what's going to happen in Jardin. And more specifically, does this relate to Nora? Because Nora has now left her name, no longer has it. Kevin, she says,
her name, you mean when she becomes Sarah?
Yeah, she becomes Sarah, different person. She no longer has Kevin in her life and denounces him, but just says, I don't know who that is.
Doesn't mean anything to me.
And she's completely alone, just getting, and again, the visual motif of the birds. Is this something that will happen to Nora? Does she have so much faith in what Kevin could potentially be doing that she either screws it up? Or does Kevin screw it up and she leaves? Is Kevin the family? Like, they're like, okay, hey, I'm doing what I'm doing and we're here and then nothing really happens. And then they kind of leave the wife. Or is Kevin the woman who does what he needs to do in terms of what they're talking about and him living and whatever, and Nora leaves like the family.
We're going to have to revisit this cold open at the end of the season to see.
Right, because you know what's coming back.
I'm just like, I have no idea. I really don't. You're like, is it Nora? Is it Kevin? And I'm like, I don't know. It's some red-haired girl who stood on top of her house, and I don't know who she's meant to represent. Just know they had birds, and they wore white, and there was a lot of things there. I don't know. I can't yet say who they are supposed to represent.
Right. All. And the other thing that I've seen people kind of talking about is this a direct correlation to the Guilty Remnant and also Evie in particular? Because, you know, they show the transition from the sky they show the transition from the lady laying down in the place next to what could be apparently dead bodies. I don't know.
I thought they were all alive just cuddling because they were so sad and cold after staying out in their house all night that they were like, let's go to the church and just cuddle and pull ourselves together.
And let's also talk about that, too, because what if that is actually dead bodies?
Why would they be dead?
Because there was a big storm, if you recall. A big storm. And everybody was out in their roofs. And maybe they were putting the dead bodies in the church to get rid of them. And if that were the case, that also says to me, the woman who survives and then walks to the church with the beautiful Max Richter piano playing over it. Oh, my God. That she considers her life now void.
Yeah, I just took it to mean that after each time that they thought it was going to happen, the next morning they all just kind of hung out and went to church together or to their meeting place.
Right.
So that's why she just knew what she was doing. I did not take them to be dead bodies, but if they were dead, exactly, that would be...
Yeah, that's intense, right?
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, does that... you have the transition of the lady laying down next to all the people in the white. And then, of course, that transitions to Evie laying down next to all the people in the white and coming out and realizing, oh, my God, everything I gave my life to, it was for this one moment from season two where they overtake Miracle. And this was the culmination of what everything I was trying to do. I was trying to make Miracle an equal place for everybody and tell everybody that this is full of crap. And she comes out, they do it, they storm the town of Miracle, and then what? There's nothing when she finds out that Meg has no plan. Meg has no plan whatsoever. It's just, hey, I'm here, I'm doing what I'm doing, and sorry, that's it. And that is indicative, possibly, of what this lady is going through, too. But the bird motif is something that kind of keeps it going for me between Nora and the lady in the cold open as opposed to Evie in the lady in the cold open. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
I just want to jump into the people I care about.
Okay, well,
that's the problem. Like, I like the cold opens, but I'm kind of like, I don't know these people. I don't care about these people. I know they're deep and symbolic and stuff, and I know that this show is symbolic, but just show me the people I like, or the people I don't even like, for real.
Well, then let's talk about the Guilty Remnant first.
Yeah.
Can you believe?
No. I'm like, John, I'm like, maybe it was a fake thing again. You know, Evie, she did it before. Like, no, when that happened, when the Guilty Remnant got blown up.
Blown the hell up.
You know who I'm mad at right now?
Who we met?
Liv Tyler.
Why?
Because we interviewed her.
And she didn't tell us.
She didn't tell us, like, oh, by the way, my character's dead.
Well, I'm not sure if she's supposed to say that.
I know.
It just makes you wonder, however, is she really dead? All right, here's a bit of casting thing. She was like severely pregnant at this point. What we found out from her was that she was filming and that she was pregnant while filming.
Yes.
So does that mean that they can incorporate that into the story, or did they choose not to?
I thought they were going to incorporate her pregnancy in the story with the fact that she sexually assaulted Tommy.
Right.
And rape Tommy. I thought she was going to be pregnant in season 3 and they were just going to be like, okay, Liv Tyler's pregnant. Let's make a way to make this work in the script.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if she truly is dead and if we're going to Australia, I'm really glad they didn't fly a severely pregnant woman to Australia from one woman who's been pregnant twice before. I'm like, good, keep that girlfriend there. And if all she had to do was film in Texas, you know, a little bit for those, that scene, then wow. Good. Good for her. Good for her family. She could take care of her baby. But I am shocked that the Guilty Remnant was blown up. What is up with this, like, tobacco military
group? Atfec.
Atfec.
Alcohol. Affleck. Not Affleck. We've already talked about Ben Affleck.
I call
Affleck.
Them Affleck. Not Ben Affleck. I think about the duck.
No, I know. Quack.
I think about the duck now with missiles.
It's alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, which is the ATF, which actually exists in the real world today.
Why would they blow up the Guilty Remnant? Okay. Why would they burn all these people's bodies in, like, what, season 1?
Let me finish. It's alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosions, and cults. At
oh.
Okay.
Okay.
So that, remember, these were the guys who in season 1 went to Wayne's complex.
Yeah, and like shot and all those shot girls.
There was zero Fs given by the ATFEC people.
Wait, so ATFEC really exists in our, like, if there was a cult here in Rhode Island, and if ATFEC found out about it, they could blow them up or something?
Well, no. ATF exists right now in the real world. There's no such thing as ATFEC in the real world.
Okay, I'm really glad you clarified this. Not like I'm planning on joining a cult.
After the departure, they expanded the ATF into the ATFEC.
What's the E again?
Explosives.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's the difference.
Okay.
So that says to you a couple of different things, too. I mean, these people are innocent people. Yes, they had done what they had done. They had raided the town.
I would not call them innocent.
Well, does their actions or do their actions warrant that kind of response from the federal government?
Nope.
No. And the federal government knows it, by the way, because as Kevin has said to Tommy, listen, the story is that there was a gas leak and everybody was in there because they were lighting cigarettes. There's a gas leak and boom, it blowed up. And sorry, that sucks, bro. Mm-hmm. But we all know, because we saw, that a drone came and blew them all to high hell.
I love how Meg was just like, you can talk. You don't need to keep writing.
Yeah.
And basically it was like, oh, and then the tigers bit their face off. Like, it's like Meg knew.
Oh,
Meg
guaranteed.
Just knew, like, nobody's come after us. We're going to get blown up, probably.
I like what she said to Evie, too, which was, Evie holds up the sign that says, what are we waiting for?
Yes.
And Meg says to her, man, you should be the leader. You are way better at this than I am. And
yes.
Then, of course, she goes into the story, and you hear the drilling in the background with the little, like,
probe.
The fiber optic eye. And she starts talking about Siegfried and Roy.
Yes.
You know, and the tigers, and it's about time. It's a matter of time since, you know, one of those effers get you. That, to me, explains that she just literally had no idea what she what she was really going for other than shock value.
Yeah.
And if they do kill Evie and Meg off, are you, my love, are you happy knowing that they killed them off this early? Or do you think it's a missed opportunity? Do you think they could have kept going with it? Or was it a necessary thing to move the story forward? Because you put so much time and effort into Evie and even Meg.
I'm over them.
You're over it.
I'm over them. I am on to the supernatural stuff that happened in to Kevin in season two. I'm ready for Australia. I'm ready for the next level. You know, the Guilty Remnant is just so vanilla by this point. And I'm meaning that, but I'm pumping because they were white. it's just humans. You know what I mean? There's nothing mythological. There's nothing, as I said, supernatural or just really... I don't even know if I can call it supernatural, but you guys know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, Meg is human. Evie's human. Yes, we understand that. But, like, why can't Kevin die? You know, this is the kind of... What is up with Dean and these canine DNA? Do I need to even care about it? What is going on? Why did the dog get the peanut butter sandwich? What's going on in Australia? That's the stuff I care about. And I think if I cared still about the Guilty Remnant, my mind would be stuck in Mapleton, or my mind would be stuck in Jardin.
I think they probably have run their course. I think you're right. And it's good to get away from the Guilty Remnant because it didn't bog the first season down.
Yeah.
But it kind of led to this really dour sense of what was happening in season one. And it was almost a little liberating to get away from them in season two. Of course, it was great to have them in the finale. And do what they did and discover what was happening, and seeing Meg go along with Tommy and I don't like the fact that she raped him, but it was compelling television to see what she was planning and how Tommy became a part of that. That to me was interesting. And I also liked seeing how she was her own sect of the Guilty Remnant. She didn't care whatsoever about the rules.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was great to see that. Now it's time, I think you're right, to get to the point and get forward with what Kevin is doing in Jardin and eventually what we assume will be Australia. One last question about Meg and Evie. Kevin brings up, I'm sorry, not Kevin, I'm thinking Kevin Carroll. John brings up the fact to Kevin that Evie may or may not be dead. And he thinks, am I just supposed to go along with that because they found her dental records? And Kevin's like, yeah, guy, you're supposed to go along with that. It's dental records. They're dead. And it's kind of hard to see how they would bring her back. You saw the missile in her glass, in her glasses, come right up to her and blow the hell out of that.
But John's talking to a guy that has come back from the dead.
I understand that. That said, is it possible that we see Evie and Meg in the hotel?
Anything is possible. Oh, in the hotel?
Yes.
Most certainly you can see them. They're dead.
Yes, I think we're going
to
see them
again. I hope I get to see the balloons again. I hope I get to see all sorts of people again in that hotel. That hotel was weird.
Right. You know, I wonder, here's an idea. Oh, should I say this?
Maybe that's what Liv was doing. Maybe Liv is filming in the hotel scenes.
That's what I'm thinking.
Pregnant.
And if you remember from the trailers of season three, you see Kevin in an airport.
Yes.
I wonder if Kevin, like, everyone has talked about how Leftovers, spoiler alert, was filming in Australia. I wonder if the hotel changes venues to Australia. And part of that is him being in an airport. Think about that.
I don't know, man.
That is so freaking cool if that were the case. I think that would be awesome if it was in the airport. And he gets to see I don't know. This is a take in development. Okay, I have nerds down the hall working on this take right now.
It's beyond my comprehension right now. I'm on so much Dayquil. I have no idea. All right, back to Jardin. So this is of course 3 years later, and Kevin is now, like, you know, the chief. He has a horse. Tommy's in the police force. Kevin still wears his Mapleton hat. Mm-hmm. And of course, everything says Jardin.
Right.
I didn't know if they were going to be switching things. Definitely say Miracle.
No, and that I think is a good explanation for what the government has done. They have wiped their hands completely.
Yes.
I wouldn't be surprised if the national park, as I put it in quotations,
yeah,
has been revoked from Jardin.
I would agree.
And now it is just Jardin.
Yeah, everything said Jardin.
Yes.
Like everything there was Jardin. Dirty Santa's still there holding on to his, you know, his pole. I mean, God, that guy's been there for so long. The only thing to trump his height was the giant Gary Busey, which I love that they just threw Gary Busey back in there. That was in, I think, maybe the opener of season two.
Season one.
Season one. When they were talking about, yes!
When the bartender was like, you know, the Pope I get, but Gary effing Busey?
Yes. So that was great just to throw that in there. And how the hell these guys made a giant inflatable Gary Busey? I hope they give it to Gary.
Right. They actually had to call him for his permission. You know that?
No.
I read a great article that they were like, okay, we want to do something funny. They wanted to get in, they wanted to comment on the political nature of what was happening with the departure. And, you know, there are people that take it wicked seriously, dude. Like there are like the Guilty Remnant, wicked serious.
Yeah.
Then you have a bunch of bros, like trolls that go up there and all they do is just rank on it and they make fun of it. So they bring up the giant 20-foot Gary Busey.
I don't know if they were ranking on it. They seemed kind of like pumped and now they get to be deputies.
Right.
They got little stickers that said you're a deputy. So of course this opens with Tommy's birthday. And we get to see that Lily's missing.
Mm-hmm.
We reaffirm that Lily is missing. It's this really weird family dynamic because when Kevin comes home from work, he goes and John is now doing the handprint thing. What? But it's because Lori is Facebook stalking these poor people. And then John and Lori have like a little mini makeout session in front of Kevin. That was awkward. Was that awkward for you?
It was wicked awkward, dude.
Okay.
But you find out that John and Lori are married now.
Yeah, but still, it was still awkward for me. I mean, 3 years. What?
Right.
And Kevin's just there smiling, happy as can be, but...
Well, he's got Nora. He's moved on. He has his life with her.
I know, but it's really interesting. And granted, he and Lori had been very distant for super long.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't... That was unexpected.
I liked when Jill showed up and she's like, is this where all the effed up people live? Yes.
I love Jill now. I used to hate Jill.
Wearing a Nirvana t-shirt.
Right? Remember when we hated Jill?
I hated Jill. She was so whiny.
And now I dig her a little bit.
I'm into her.
Yeah. Not like into her. But
No. Although Mark Aquali, I'm not going to... Oh, you haven't seen The Nice Guys yet. If you guys get a chance, watch the movie The Nice Guys with Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling.
Oh, that guy.
That guy. Just that dude. Margaret Qualley plays in The Nice Guys, and she's a fantastic role.
How'd you feel about that party?
I thought it was a great party. I really loved the scene when they're talking about what they were doing when they were 25.
Yes.
And, you know, it's funny because you get your heart warmed by that story that Kevin tells about Lori. And you can see the pleasure on his face talking about it. Like, it's a fond, fond memory. And of course, it does build to the other part, which is, you know, him saying, you know, kismet or just the fates, you know.
Divine intervention.
Of course, you see Matt's ears and Michael's ears pop up. You know, they perk up when he talks about that because they are writing a book about Kevin and Kevin doesn't know about it yet. So do you fault Michael and Matt and even John? John is participating in this too for writing this book about Kevin. Because as Damon said in our interview with him in episode 40, you can't kill Kevin off and then bring him back to life and then nobody talks. Everybody would be talking about this.
I just love how nobody's been talking about it with Kevin. It's been 3 years and nobody's been like, hey, so we need to have a chat because that was weird. That was bananas. Like they've just been writing this book just by themselves.
Yep.
Chatting about it. I want to know. So Nora didn't seem to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else
don't think she
did.
I don't think anybody else did. I think they were keeping it on the DL. And they weren't saying anything to anybody, but they are, in fact, writing this book. And do you think that is something that you would be okay with if you were Kevin or if you were these guys? Do you think it's worth noting? Because we've seen Matt come to these points in his life where it's one extreme to the other, right? It's, you know, I'm going to badmouth all the people, you know, from season one. Or now I'm going to write this book because Kevin is the Messiah, you know, like, or maybe he is. I don't know. The beard looks good on him, you know, like.
I loved that quote.
Is this something that is indicative of a crazy person, or is this something that is worth noting for Matt in capturing in book form? What do you think?
If someone doesn't write it down, then no one's going to know about this. So yeah, you need to write it down. Mm-hmm. Kevin's weird, man. All right. That's it.
So is Matt. I mean,
everybody's weird except Michael.
I mean, well, Matt is keeping his
Michael
family.
And Jill. That means they broke up. She didn't even come in and give him a little kiss.
Oh, good point.
Oh, ruh-roh.
Well, you know, you don't bring sand to the beach.
Listen, what does that even mean?
You don't bring the boyfriend to college.
True.
You know what I'm saying?
Why didn't he go to college?
Because maybe he's stuck writing an effing book with Matt that nobody's going to read. At least, maybe not.
Okay. Why was Nora's arm broken or wrist broken?
Well, I think that's something that's going to end up coming out soon. And I wonder if something had to do with Kevin about that.
Ooh,
I don't know.
That would be awkward. I would say no.
I would say no, too.
Because I feel like if she was itching it, he would have been like, listen, once again, I know I've said it 100 times, but I'm really sorry. Yeah, I don't think Kevin was involved. What I do think is interesting is this whole 7 years, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at a 2-week distance. I do wonder if this season is going to take place within these 2 weeks,
yep.
or if like next episode is October 14th and nothing happens, or if something happens. But I'm interested that they've given us this timeline that we have like 2 weeks to go, where it's the next 7 years have passed since the departure, and big things happen in the Bible every 7 years. So I'm excited about that. Yeah, I don't know what happened to Lily. I'm not even going to make up ideas about what happened to Lily, even though I thought of one. Okay, fine. I'm going to make up the idea. What if someone came back like for Lily that was biologically related?
Okay. What do you mean?
What happened to her mom? Didn't she just disappear?
Oh, that was the Chinese girl. Didn't she get, she left.
Oh, no, what was her name?
I don't remember her name off the top of my head.
But what if she comes back for Lily?
That's a distinct possibility. So, although, yeah, she left. I remember that at the end of season one, she got on the bus and she left, and she yeah. left Lily
so
there.
I'm wondering if she came back for Lily and took Lily. That's what I'm wondering if happened to her.
I doubt that. Because they officially adopted her. Kevin and Nora, they officially adopted her. So there's no way that she can come back.
Did Lily die? Oh,
okay. No.
We're just not exploring Lily because I'm already upset about it. Peanut butter. I do love peanut butter. So let's go from a sad topic to a happy topic, okay?
Okay, let's do it.
Dean, listen. Whoever this actor is, I'm never going to be able to see him in anything ever again, because I'm just going to think that's the weird dog shooting guy. But this whole thing about how he thinks the senator has canine DNA, what is going on? I kind of forgot about that plot line because I just wasn't interested. So I'm really now wondering, are dogs going to be playing a point in season three? Do mm-hmm. we actually need to think about dogs? And I thought maybe he's just crazy and he's just another loose string. And of course he tries to shoot Kevin because Kevin didn't believe him. Poor Kevin went to Lori and was like, hey, listen, there's this old guy that was my friend and I just want you to check up on him. Like, I feel like Kevin did a really nice thing. Mm-hmm. He didn't just blow the guy off entirely. He actually went to go find him help. And then he tries to kill Kevin. And after, when his body is buried, a dog goes and takes the sandwich.
Right.
That was so weird.
So, and that's the beautiful thing about The Leftovers, because they're not always going to tell you, yes, you're right, but no, you're wrong either. Remember when Lori was talking to Kevin in season two about seeing Patty? She was like, listen, there are things. The reason why you know all this stuff about Patty and the story and about the bag of shit that she lit on fire, the reason why you know that
watch
is because...
Watch your language, you're on live.
I'm on Facebook Live, I know. The reason why you know all that is because I told you, and it is your subconscious acting out, and you are seeing Patty because your subconscious is demanding it. But then again, there was also this other side of it too that was the international assassin. It was Patty knowing certain things that maybe not necessarily everybody would. Mm-hmm. And that's what this show was doing again. do I really think there are things taking the form of dogs and then thereby senators who only eat peanut butter sandwiches? Like, you're right. Who the hell eats a sandwich without jelly? Except maybe my kid. My son.
Yeah, he doesn't like jelly. Oh my God. We have to get his DNA checked.
So
just one of those weird things that I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be a throwaway. That's just, you know, what Damon is creating and Tom are creating and the whole team, I feel like they create a labyrinth. Mm-hmm. And especially this early in the season, it's a total labyrinth. You go in and you're like, all right, I'm going to go left, right, or straight. All right, I'm going to go dog DNA peanut butter route. I'm going to go think about that. And then we might come in, it might be a dead end. And we'd be like, okay, maybe I should think about something else.
But bringing Dean back is very important. And I have a feeling that this is not the only person we're going to see from season one, because it is now bringing everything back full circle. And when Dean showed up in season one, dude, things got strange.
Things got really strange. Right?
So now that he is back and he's trying to kill Kevin for turning into one of them and being a traitor, and things are going to get strange again. And I think they're going to get far more strange than we actually think that they're going to.
So am I bad that I wished that Kevin had gotten shot just so that Tommy could have seen him not die? I really kind of thought, oh, he or Tommy just got shot. Like, that one of them is shot. And I really hoped that he was shot and he wasn't. But what was neat was when he got up after he and Nora had a little fling in bed the next morning after she went on her bike. He got up and we got to see his tattoos. Mm-hmm. And they really spent a lot of time on his tattoos. And it wasn't until my second time watching it that I got to see this red wound on his back. And it was like a shiny red wound. Mm-hmm. It's the exit wound from when John must have shot him.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Because I'm like, Justin Theroux doesn't have that on his back naturally. And they wouldn't be spending this much time on him if right. It wasn't important to show you, like, no, this was a big deal. Like, this wound is still here. It is still healing 3 years later.
Yep.
It is, he should have died. And then, of course, he suffocates himself with the dry cleaning stuff. So that's why I just feel like, you know, why is he doing this? Why is he duct taping dry clean plastic over his face? And we couldn't see the end. We saw him gasping for air. Mm-hmm. Is he trying to get back to the hotel? Is he trying to die? I mean, he didn't die when he got shot. He didn't die when he jumped into the water to drown because right. The earthquake happened. He did die when he drank poison mm-hmm. and he was buried. Okay. So that happened. But is he that was the only time he got to go to the hotel. Mm-hmm. So is he trying to do that again? Is he trying and failing to die over and over? I wish I could have seen, like, does he just give up and be like, oh, well, done this for 10 minutes, like, oops. Snip it open. Yeah. Like,
yeah, it brings in the mechanics of what he's trying to do in question. Is he literally trying to die? Because if you remember from season two, Kevin died. Kevin did die. Yes. When he took the poison, he was dead, dead, dead.
Yes.
But he came back. So is he trying to die for the sake of dying, or is he trying to die to get back to the hotel?
Both.
Does he have things to accomplish in the hotel?
Or does he just want to see if he can die? You know, he's mad at Matt and he's mad at...
Well, this is prior to knowing Matt was writing the book.
Yeah, but I'm just referencing it because think about it. This guy knows he should have died.
Right.
Kevin knows he should have died.
Multiple times over.
He hasn't been talking about it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't just chat with people. And
he's like a 50-year-old Boston Irish Catholic woman who just
ignore the issue.
Puts it right under the rug.
That's it. We're just not going to talk about that weird stuff that all of you know happened to me. I mean, each of these people knows that he almost died and should have died in different ways, and he just doesn't talk about it. I mean, Tommy's birthday party is a perfect example. He's on the porch with all these people who know he should have died, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, I mean, seeing the action of him breathing in that bag was, it was actually quite disturbing. And to think about that as an actor, and think about that as a person who's, you have to watch that on the set and be like, bro, get ready with the pin because we're going to go tag it real quick so you can breathe. I was really impressed with Thoreau and how he approached this. And you can tell too that this is something that is not done, you know, willy-nilly. This was not the first time he's ever done it. He has the bag with the duct tape and the plastic. It's marked cufflinks for a reason. So that it's an innocuous thing, apparently, but it's not, because, you know, it seems like it's happening more often than not. And another clue, a small clue, that it could be him wanting to get back to the hotel is, if you remember, for him to get out of the hotel, he had to sing Homeward Bound by Simon Garfunkel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
What was playing when he was trying to kill himself and apparently did? Everything is Groovy by Simon and Garfunkel, right? That, you know, you don't just put that in there for no reason. Like that is a clear sign of what they're trying to accomplish. It's possible that he was trying to get back to the hotel. Speaking of songs, by the way, one of the things that I wanted to bring up too was this song. I forget who it's by, and I will look it up. I will find out. But it was the song when he's riding the white horse, no less.
I love that it was a white horse
in Jardin and bringing people to the town. But it was a song that was entitled "Sign of the Judgment," and the lyrics are "The sign of the judgment." Hail, oh, the time draws nigh, the sign of the fig tree, sign in the fig tree, the sign in the fig tree. There's a loose horse in the valley, a loose horse in the valley, so on. And tell me who's going to ride him, who is going to ride him. And I wonder if that was a reference to Kevin, that he is indeed the loose horse in the valley. And he is the person that is just kind of going on and living his life, and there's no real direction, and he is the loose horse. And they made a specific reference to that, like him riding in town, and they kept that what's the term that you use for lyrics when it's the verse? They kept playing that verse over and over again.
Okay.
And in specific reference to Kevin. And I just thought that was, by the way, that song too has now invaded my life. I've played that now in my office and people are like, dude, what are you listening to?
I love that you could like get to listen to adult music. To listen to Let It Go. And,
over and over and over and over again. Oh, it's the McIntosh County Shouters. That's who it is. And I really like the song. I think it's a wicked cool song. And they played it once in the beginning and they played it once at the end when Kevin was reading his book. Or when Kevin was about to burn the book and he didn't, because the airplane was writing "The End Is Nigh."
This sign of the judgment.
Yeah, this song.
This sign of the judgment.
That's so good.
It is a good song.
So that song was playing twice throughout the episode. Again, another clear sign of what they're trying to do. They're trying to tell you what Kevin is.
See? What is he?
He's the loose horse. That's the lyric. It's the loose horse in the valley. So that's that.
I don't pay attention enough to music.
Well, that's... And coming from you, that is obscene. Because you are the musician in this family.
I had the flu.
I know. And I love you for it. And please, for those of you who are listening right now to the podcast, or for those of you who are watching us live on Facebook Live, please give my wife some love, because she is a trooper. she totally knocked this one out of the park. Anything else you want to tackle, my love?
Hey, Kevin got baptized.
Didn't count, though, as Kevin said. Mm. And do you think he knew, even if there was poison?
He knew he wasn't going to die from it. He was like, whatever, I can't die. I'll at least go drink the water. And then I could tell people like, oh, yeah, it is poison. Mm-hmm. Help, take me to a hospital. Wink, wink, just drive me home. Mm-hmm. What I was upset about was his walkie-talkies probably ruined. All that stuff got wet.
You are something, dude.
That's what I realized. I'm like, he didn't take any of that off. He just jumped on in. Yeah. He doesn't care. he's got Nora's honey badger instinct right now. He doesn't think he can die. So even if there was poison, oops, maybe I'd die. Maybe that something will kill me, or it probably won't kill me, and I'll just find out if there is poison, or if there's no poison, I'll find out that way too. And I love how Tommy calls him out on it.
Right.
He's like, you didn't know. You didn't know.
This is one thing I want to bring up too. Kevin tells Dean, listen, all this stuff that you're talking about, it's all in your head. You're making this up. Yet, when Tommy is talking about killing people and have you ever killed somebody, Kevin's saying, yeah, I killed somebody before. But he didn't. He killed Patty in International Assassin.
Yeah.
And that was in his head. That wasn't real. It was in his. So is Kevin denying the fact that he is crazy, or is he accepting it and putting it off as it is real? But it did mess with him. Like, it messed with him mentally, but I'm not sure if you can have it both ways. Either you believe in what you believe, or there's reality, and there's no middle in between the two. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes.
So I wonder if Kevin really uses those experiences, and has that really affected him? And I love, speaking of International Assassin, the quick hit of Kevin coming out of the tub as he was being dunked into the water of Jarden by Michael. It was his rebirth. Kevin was a different person once he was out of the hotel. He was reborn after the hotel, just as how you, when you are baptized, you are reborn, rebirth. I just think that's so cool. Really, and Mimi Leader knocked it out of the park, by the way, as Damon said. Totally killed it. You know, a lot of people talk about Michelle McLaren as a powerhouse female director, and they should, because she is. Anna Forster, also a powerhouse female director. But Mimi Leader, in my opinion, is the most talented out of those guys. The most talented. They are phenomenal. And she is just out of this world, and you have to give it to her. I mean, she has really developed a beautiful show and took what what the heck was the guy's name, the director who directed the pilot, guys, please, what,
someone just said something very brilliant.
What?
Inside the Facebook chat.
Okay.
Kevin Senior is obsessed with peanut butter.
Really?
Season one, Kevin Junior visits him at the institution. He brought him peanut butter. Mm-hmm. Kevin Sr. also hid 20,000 in a peanut butter jar for Matt to find in season one.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Weird.
Right?
Great. Great. By the way, Peter Berg, thank you, Paul Patty, for bringing that up. Peter Berg was the guy. So Mimi Leader took what Peter Berg accomplished and made it her own, although keeping the same DNA, which was really great. That was awesome. But yeah, obsessed with peanut butter.
I am. What does that make me?
Maybe if I blow the whistle, you'll come and start eating Reese's peanut butter sandwiches.
I can't do anything right now.
Anything else you got, my love?
That is it.
Well, all right, fine. Let's get into some of the listener feedback that we have. All right, from Shakita, she says, hey guys, I think it's crazy how Kevin tried to kill himself with the plastic bag and the duct tape in the season 2 episode International Assassin. When Kevin was going to see Patty Levin, he walks past a guy wearing a Mapleton police uniform with a bag over his head at the 26-minute mark. You may want to check that. I bet that was Kevin in a different timeline. What do you think about that?
Holy smokes, didn't even notice it. I have to go back and watch it. That would be amazing.
That is freaking an unbelievable note there, Shakita. Thank you. I let's see what else we got here. From Keith Goldsboro on Twitter, he says, I think Matt planned the whole toxic waste in the water just so Kevin would get baptized. There's something going on with Matt. And Keith, yes, there's definitely, as always, something going on with Matt. And I don't know if he planned it, but I don't think he was upset about it. I mean, he called Kevin and said that there was a problem, but these people were legitimately pissed.
Oh, yeah.
The protesters talking about Meg and Evie and bringing them up like they are martyrs almost. You know, again, remember how we talked about how people react to certain things. You know, you can look at the Guilty Remnant as crazy people, or you can look at them as martyrs and be like, was this right? You can have that whole debate about what the government did to them.
Yes.
Is this a right thing? So those were legitimately pissed. People legitimately pissed, and they were getting rocks thrown at them. So for Matt to plan all of that, that would be...
That'd be intense.
That would be intense. So we get some voicemails. You ready to... let's play some of those.
Hey, this is Scott from Kentucky. Wow. That was an amazing season 3 premiere. And the more I think back about it, the more there was to mine. It's so much like a really good Lost episode. There's just a lot of stuff there if you're paying attention. And I probably missed half of it. But
you have to go back, Kate.
A couple of questions in no particular order. After, you know, John does his thing with reading the handprints and gets a little bit of help helping the person. He takes the money. He comes upstairs. And did he shred that money, that $80? And if so, why? That was totally unexpected. I had the feeling that this was just kind of a cottage industry. But, of course, they did it right in front of Kevin. So all of that was just really interesting. Speaking about Kevin, a couple of things. When he selects his uniform and then takes the bag, puts it over his head, at first I thought that was kind of maybe a thrill thing or an autoerotic thing. And I was also scared that that was going to be the last we're going to see of him. I think later, when it's very clear that Matt and John are onto him, they think they know who he is, you kind of wonder if Kevin's been testing himself in some way, or that maybe Kevin has an inkling about himself. So that really all made me think there. The other thing is, when he emerges from the spring, he goes right by Matt and says, it didn't count, or that didn't count, if I heard that correctly. You kind of wonder, why did he say that? So there's just so many layers, like a really nice onion, to think through here. And then, of course, the end was gobsmacking, because you see, you know, more carrying pigeons, and it's clear that you're kind of in a similar place as you were in the cold open. And then, you know, I actually thought it was going to be Kevin's dad who'd been riding all that time on the bike, maybe with really, really long hair, because I think he's supposed to be in Australia. And then it turns out to be somebody who looks a lot like Nora. So, wow. Can't wait to hear what you all do, what everybody else has to say about this. But I am so excited for these last 10 episodes, and very, very grateful that you all have done some really great work lining up interviews, and are going to give us such enjoyment from this podcast. Thanks again.
Scott, thank you so much for calling in. First, yes, they did shred the $80. And that is because I think they're just happy to be helping people. And that, to me, screams Lori. John is in on it because he knows the gig, he knows the racket. But Lori is there actually helping get people to move past their problems. And another thing, too, it is not going to be 10 episodes this season. It is going to be 8, only 8 episodes
so
this
sad.
Season. It is a little sad.
Hey, Mary and Blake. My name is Scarlett, and I've been listening to you guys since season 1. I'm so excited for the return of my favorite TV show. I had been listening to the soundtrack in anticipation of season 3, and I was reminded of how emotional and visceral the music is and how much the show gets to the core of human emotion. I'm so excited that it's back. So a few things about episode 1. The whole dog thing. So Dean's back. He was one of the more interesting characters on season 1 because we never really knew if he was insane or wise. On the one hand, he had this whole otherworldly persona about him, where he almost reminded us of Virgil of the Underworld.
Oh, good one.
But Dean sometimes just seems straight up crazy. And I think his current, the dogs are trying to take over the planet theory, toes the exact line of, is this possible or is this insanity? The dog whistle and Dean's comment that Kevin is has changed seems to both be clues that maybe Dean knows more than we give him credit for, especially considering that everyone in the Leftovers universe has changed dramatically in one way or another. Anyways, regardless of whether the writers decided to throw with a red herring, I think it demonstrates that the world of the Leftovers is one of unabashed faith and doubt constantly colliding. The intro of the episode was a great example of how faith is developed, supported, tested, and transformed. We see that same transformation of faith in so many of the characters this season. I think one of the main themes that the Leftovers will grapple with this season more than anything is the issue of faith in a world that both desperately seeks to find answers, but also simultaneously questions everything, not unlike, you know, our own world. Anyway, thank you for podcasting this phenomenal show, and I'm so excited for the rest of the season. This is the first time that I've called into a podcast, and I'm so nervous. I don't know why. So thank you so much for all the work that you guys have done. I love listening to you guys every week. All right, thanks.
Skyla, thank you for calling in, and don't ever be nervous to call us. Don't ever. No one should be nervous to call us. We're just two jabronis sitting. Well, I'm the jabroni, and this is the
The girl with the flu,
and the pretty girl with the flu sitting across from me with microphones in our face. We're just fans. We're nothing more than that. But you did an excellent job. Thank you for calling.
You know, I love your idea with Dean and with the dogs. Aren't dogs like a sign of the underworld?
Yes, they are.
In like what is it? Egyptian faith?
Yes. Because they worshipped cats, but dogs were the opposite of the cats. Oof. So that's
why I'm not a dog person.
Hey, Mary and Blake. This is Armando calling from California. Big fan of your show.
Thank you. Big fan of you.
I guess, you know, to answer your question or the question that you put out there, what about the sequence, opening sequence? I think, you know, I maybe have to go back to see the beginning again, but weren't they quoting from the book of Kevin? As the show opened, you know, so I think that, you know, that's probably in the future, because if you see like the pigeons, the way that they got the pigeons communicating, it's the same way that Nora or Sarah at the very end kind of has those pigeons and is using it the very same way. So I think that, you know, that's how, maybe the projection of what, you know, the future would look like once, you know, the floods come and maybe technology and everything else is destroyed. So I'm not sure, you know, if this will really pan out unless there's time travel or something. But maybe, you know, the 1844 would be, you know, 1844 from the year maybe Kevin was born or from the year of this catastrophic, you know, flood. But I'm definitely interested in hearing what everyone else, you know, thinks. So cool. Looking forward to listening tonight.
Well, thank you for calling in, Armando. And I don't think that the prologue was in the future. I mean, they did say August 1845. The guy circles it when the rapture does not happen, and they keep changing the date. And now, as you've probably already heard, Tom has referenced the Millerites, and it may not be a direct reference, but it at least is something that they're pointing towards.
Yeah.
So I don't think that this came from,
however, how freaking cool that it could be, because if there is a massive flood, civilization is going to have to take some time to rebuild.
Well, Matt did talk about this giant flood, and it may be coming. And how cool is it that his son is named Noah?
I love it.
And but it is sad, of course, that his wife and his son Mary they're leaving. And it's all due to Matt.
Is she going to fall back in her coma?
That's the thing. Like, is she going to do that? Is Matt right? Is Jardin this really special place where she will fall back into her coma?
And I'm surprised she's not nervous to leave.
I would be nervous to leave, too, because you don't necessarily know.
And she, like, knows Kevin can't die. Like, that's the thing. Like, she could maybe pull off, okay, it was just time that took me out of my coma. But she also knows Kevin can't die.
Right.
Like, there is something special going on, whether it is Jardin or if it's just in general going on.
Or is she so fed up that she's just like, I've had enough of this. All of it is junk. It just happens to be that Kevin, yes, he survived these things.
I know what it is.
What?
She wants to go to Harry Potter World just like me, and she knows she can't do it if she just stays in Jardin all the time.
You're a wizard, Harry.
So you know what, Mary? From one Mary to another, I'm going to raise a glass to you, and I hope you get to go on the Hogwarts Express.
Hey, this is Rafe Collins Jr. Good to be back. It's good to be watching with you guys. I love the cold open. Sometimes the theme music for the show can sort of act as this sort of barrier between the show and the real world, and not having anything music or anything like that just kind of throws you in the deep end. I will have to say, I know you guys are asking about the cold open, but Kevin's attitude, like, in this first episode of the show is driving me up a wall. After everything that's happened to him, he's still trying to use, like, a normal worldview and a normal paradigm to process things. There is no normal. Normal is gone. There's no normal. I was talking about this on the thread. There is no normal. There is no, that can't happen. That's not scientifically possible. I think anything can happen. And I think the supernatural has become natural in the world of the leftovers. So that's all I want to say. It's good to have you guys back.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Rafe.
Thank you.
It's good to be back and good to have guys like you and ladies like Scarlett and all the people who called in and everybody here in the Facebook Live chat room to be back and have our community back. That's what I miss most about podcasting with the show. Like, I love watching The Leftovers. It is what it is. But being able to chat with everybody that is there, I'm pointing at the camera, or listening to us on the podcast right now, that's what's most important to me.
Mary, Blake, and the rest of the Living Reminders, it's Brian Davids from the Film Schlubs podcast, and I'm thrilled that you invited me back to do this segment for the third and final season of the best Leftovers podcast there is. If the Book of Kevin is any indication, we're going to have a lot to talk about each week, as The Leftovers has once again raise the bar for the rest of television. I now want to focus on the three season premieres that we've seen to this point. Season 1 established this post-departure world in a gloomy and bleak part of New York, which was compounded by the presence of the Guilty Remnant. However, Season 2's premiere served as a palate cleanser, as the show really wanted to create a new impression in critics' and fans' minds, even though many of us loved Season 1. The story resumed in a warm and hopeful Texas town where we met the idyllic Murphy family, or so we thought. Even the theme song changed to a more optimistic tone. In the end, though, Season 2 taught us that none of the characters could outrun their problems forever. Whether it's moving from Mapleton to Miracle, or convincing yourself that an overflowing bathtub was just a funny story. Now we've arrived at the Season 3 premiere, and it feels like an amalgamation of the first two season premieres. Kevin is back to being a cop alongside his son, much like Kevin and Kevin Sr. in Mapleton. Nora is back to work for the Department of Sudden Departures, while Matt continues to preach. Even a Season 1 favorite, Dean the Dog Hunter, was back to shooting his rifle in the middle of the street, only this time he was aiming at Kevin on the streets of Miracle. We even got a Gary Busey callback to Season 1's infamous list of celebrity departures. The most familiar scene comes when Matt and his flock are ironically dressed in white and are arguing with ATFC protesters at Season 2's famous spring where the water was potentially poisoned in this case. Kevin arrived to break up the scuffle between Matt's flock, the protesters, and Jardin police, only it intensified. The scuffle is then slowed down with music, reminding us of Kevin's fight to keep the peace between the Mapleton townsfolk and the GR during the Heroes Day parade in Season 1. So I really appreciate that our concluding chapter, Season 3, is coming full circle as elements from the first two seasons are leading us towards the story's final destination in Australia. Even the flash forwards bike ride to the church echoed Nora, Kevin, and Jill's move to Miracle. So all roads lead to the Outback, and I cannot wait to learn about the tragedies that put Nora in this position to where she doesn't want to be found by anyone. Does this add weight to Nora's belief in the lens theory? Is she purposely isolating herself from everyone she loves as a way to protect them from her? The nun seems to indicate that Kevin is trying to contact her still, as do the countless unread messages delivered by the carrier pigeons, but where is Kevin sending these messages from? After all, we've seen birds travel back and forth between the other place and reality, just like Kevin. Did Kevin end up in the other place for good? Did Nora also want to end up in the other place but couldn't? Does she feel responsible for why Kevin ended up in the other place for good? Or did the nun simply read the Book of Kevin and suspect that Sarah is the Nora of the story? Either way, I cannot wait to see how it all unfolds week to week. And I just want to close out this week's Thought of the Week with one last Season 3 prediction. I think we see the return of Christine from Season 1, and I think she's gotten her life together, and that's why Nora no longer has Lily. So Lily did not suffer some tragic fate like Nora's first two kids, but I think it's going to affect Nora the exact same way. Well, until next week, you guys can find more of me, Brian Davids, on Twitter at BDF331. Also, check out my TV film podcast at FilmSchlubsPodcast.com, where I just interviewed Vince Gilligan. Once again, thank you to Mary and Blake, and to you, the audience, for listening.
This week's Tweet of the Week comes by the way of Abby Normal at KMK Miller, and she said, you know what would be really creepy and depressing? The Leftovers Funko, which would be an empty box.
Oh.
I mean, and you know what the funny thing is?
Oh my God, what? Because I have something funny in my own mind. What? Tell me.
No, no, what? No, go ahead.
Oh my God, I was just picturing a Funko of Kevin in his sweatpants. Y'all know what I'm talking about.
It wouldn't even have legs. It would just be...
Anyway.
It would just be one long leg.
However, it's because I'm on, once again, flu medicine, and I'm trying to have a little whiskey to see if it stops my cough. Inappropriate, Mary.
Oh, my God. I'm sweating. I'm laughing so hard.
But an empty Funko box. I can't even...
And people would buy that. I guarantee you, there are freaks like me that are out there that would buy an empty Funko box just to have it sit on my shelf. But I wonder if I would buy the Kevin one more. It would at least be a Christmas gift for you.
Oh, my God. No, I don't want a Funko.
Oh, my God.
They're your favorites, not mine.
All right, you ready for the sudden theory of the week?
Yes.
All right. Well, okay. Nope.
Please hang up and try again.
That was the wrong sound, Blake. Let's do the right sound. You know, it's been a long time since I've done that, so you got to give me a little credit. Well, a little leeway here, my love. Do you have a sudden theory? Do you have anything saved up?
I never do because I always just let them lie in the podcast. So no, Blake, tell me about your sudden
theory. My sudden theory: we're not done with Meg and Evie. They're going to come back. They will be back in either Australia this idea of the airport / Australia being the other side. Or they'll be back in the hotel, which we'll see, which we know we're going to see because Damon said that we're going to see it again in our first interview with him from last season. So we know what's happening. We're going to see the hotel again.
Spoiler!
But in what form? In what form? And my idea is that it will be in the form of the airport and Australia.
Okay.
I wonder if that's the case. Could be. May not. Whatever. Who knows?
I just hope this isn't real life. I hope Damon and Tom aren't onto something in that after you die, you go to a hotel.
What? Is the hotel special to only Kevin? That's the question.
Maybe he likes hotels.
Maybe he's into it. Maybe he's into like
that's
the
where he would have his affairs.
He's in. Yeah. Good callback. Good You're callback.
Welcome. See, I have a really bad memory sometimes, but every once in a while I save some nuggets.
All right, my love. That is that. And now I get to play that sound.
Please hang up and try again.
Final thoughts? You got anything? Final last thoughts?
My final last thought is this big old weird family. It's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminds me of my family.
Yes. I would agree with that.
My family is like divorced and people are remarried and they're like best friends. And my mom, dad, and my dad's wife have wine together and they joke because my mom once brought over a wine called Ménage à Trois. It was like the brand name of the wine.
It was like this like, ooh, Ménage à Trois.
We're dirty. We're drinking a wine that says Ménage à Trois and there's three of us. And I'm like, you guys are just really weird. So I dig families and I'm digging on this effed up family.
Yes, I think I am too. For myself, a lot of people have made a big thing about Nora in Australia and the fact that she's no longer named Nora.
Is it bad that I could care less?
Well, I mean, it's, I mean, that's,
I know it's going to be a big deal,
I don't
think, but
I don't think
I'm
it's
like,
bad. But
we'll get there.
Her name was Sarah. And I, again, of course, being, I'm not going to say it, but I will say I'm a podcaster and I do my research.
Isn't she Abraham's wife?
Yes.
See, who went to more church than you? This girl.
I went to Catholic school, okay?
Yeah, but I went to church 3, sometimes 4 days a week, and I thought everyone did.
She went to Bible camp.
Shine, Jesus, shine. I know every song on the wow. That's what I call worship.
It's either that, you knew it, or you read it in my Google notes. One of the two.
I didn't look at your Google notes.
Oh, wow, okay. So a lot of people want to make this comparison to Sarah from the Bible, and I'm not sure I buy it quite yet. There are some similarities.
Do you know who Abraham is?
He is...
Before you read these notes?
He's
Father Abraham had many sons, and many sons had Father Abraham. Oh, I was one of them, and so were you. Let's all praise the Lord. Hallelujah!
Are you done? Are you just going to keep going?
I was shaking the webcam. I was so excited.
So, Sarah in the Bible, obviously, as you are now well aware, thank you to my beautiful wife, Mary, was married to Abraham. And she was actually barren until God gave her a child when she was 90 years old.
Crazy, right?
Crazy. And there are some similarities here. Nora lost her children, does not have children, and apparently does not have children from Kevin. So there is something that's there. They also left Canaan for Canaan, which was the promised land, and finally got there. And then everything seemed great until there was this famine and they had to go to Egypt. And Abraham, in fear of his own life, tried to pass Sarah off as his sister. So listen, are there direct correlations here? No, but they leave Mapleton. And they go, they think they find the promised land in Jordan. And of course, Sarah and Abraham leave for Canaan, which they think is the promised land. They get there and not everything is hunky dory. Not everything is groovy. So they leave yet apparently.
Groovy. Nice word.
I'm calling back to Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, okay.
Not everything is perfect. So where do they go? There is a famine of things that were, that they intended to happen, but didn't. And they leave, apparently, maybe, who knows, again, to go to Australia, just like how they had to leave to go to Egypt in Sarah and Abraham. And Nora is now saying she does not know Kevin. Now, that isn't the exact same, but Sarah had to say that Abraham was her brother, and Abraham had to pretend that they weren't together. So there are some similarities. If I had to buy it or sell it, I'm not going to buy it. I'm selling this.
I don't even know what that means. Buying or selling?
Yeah, you know, if you're buying it, like that means you own it. That's what you want. If you're selling it, you're trying to get rid of it. I'm selling.
Okay.
Never mind.
Is this a Boston thing?
No, it's not a Boston thing. That is what it is. So ultimately, Sarah was tortured by her childlessness, and every recorded episode of ill temper or strife in her household, of course, was related to her frustrations about her own barrenness. It ate at her. She spent years in the grip of frustration and depression because of it, and she desperately wanted to be a mother, but she finally concluded that God himself was restraining her from having children so badly that she went to her husband to have an heir, that she concocted a scheme with, which was immoral, unrighteous, and utterly foolish, which is, of course, making sure that Hagar, whatever, her handmaiden, was supposed to have a kid with with Abraham. And then she got pissed off when it actually happened and then sent the kid away. So a child from another person comes into their life. The child is sent away, kind of like how Lily came into her life. Did Nora send the child away because she was pissed off?
We don't know.
We don't know. So there are certain things here. I know I'm making a case for this being Sarah, but there are similarities. There are some things to think about. And is that name, that one name, Sarah, telling us what could happen and what's going to happen? And you start adding it to the cold open and the ending. It seems to make sense. So that is my final thought of the week. I have still yet to buy it, but we'll see. Ready to close out the show, my darling?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's do it.
All right, guys. So as we said before, we are a podcast. And here's the thing that we've learned about podcasts. People don't learn about podcasts unless their friends tell them about podcasts. So if you're listening to this or if you're watching this, please take a moment to just share it. I know it sounds a little corny, but like, share it with a friend who watches The Leftovers. Share it on your wall. Share it on Twitter or whatever. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. Our handle is Living Reminders.
And if you want to catch us on our website or anywhere else, you can always go to the livingreminders.com. And if that, of course, is not enough for you, you can always reach us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
So we are not sponsored for the show. We do it because we love it so incredibly much. But if you have had a blast listening to this, and if you want us to keep it going and just to support us, you can by going to patreon.com/tallmommedia. Tall Mom Media, because I'm a tall mom. And we run a media company. It literally can be like $2 a month, and that's cheaper than a cup of coffee. And it helps us pay for the hosting fees and pay for my whiskey for when I'm sick. True story. But really, a little bit goes a long way. And we just really want to thank all of our patrons who have made this possible, because it's an awesome hobby. It is so incredibly fun. We love the community that we have and that we get to interact with. But it's an expensive hobby. So we really appreciate all of you who have helped. So once again, that's Patreon. That's patreon.com/tallmommedia.
And if you want to catch more of Mary and I, please go to maryandblake.co. All of our podcasts, including Outlandercast, You've Been Gilmored, a show about the Gilmore Girls, Parentcast, a show about parenting and our crazy lives together, kind of behind the scenes of Mary and I. And also, Mary has this fantastic show called Wicked Roadie. It is all about the events in life of what it's like to be in Rhode Island, where we are from. So that is that. Wow. Man, we're done. We broke the cherry. That's it. We're done. First season's over.
I hate that phrase.
Sorry. I don't mean to say something that you hate.
Thank you.
Well.
All right. I'm going to go to sleep. Okay. So, until next time, ladies and gents, my name is Mary Larson.
And I'm Blake.
And you've been listening to The Living Reminders.
No. You're supposed to say, and we're still here.
Oh, my God. I didn't look at the document, and we're still here.
That's it.